Welcome to the Creative Talk podcast, where creatives talk about success, longevity, motivation, and faith. I'm Dr. Carla Scott, and this is episode one, sponsored by The Vocal Spa, vocal training for worship leaders, recording artists, and live performers. Today's guest is Carmen Balthrop, a renowned opera singer and music professor. We're going to learn all about her, and she's also going to give us her top three lessons learned about life in the spotlight. Without further ado, Carmen, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Tell me a little bit about your musical career, and just start wherever you'd like.
Well, I always start generally with the story that I was 8 years old sitting on the basement steps of my parents' home when I decided that I wanted to be an opera singer. But it was only because I was influenced by hearing opera singing coming over the radio. My father had a little shop in the basement where he repaired televisions and radios and things for friends. It was just a hobby. But this particular Saturday, he had the Texaco broadcast from the Met on, and a voice came across to me that pulled me to the steps. I heard it and I said, "Daddy, what is that?" He said, "That's opera." And I was fascinated. I said, "Who is that?" And he said, "That's Leontine Price." And I thought it was a very unusual name. I'd never heard that name, Leontine. And he said, "Oh, and she's an African American." And something shifted in me. Something that was a dream, a possibility, a connection. And I think I said to myself, "That's possible that people of my complexion can sing like that." Remember, I'm 8 years old. I hadn't heard anything like that. And so I think in that moment, the stars aligned. And I remember going upstairs. I was supposed to be vacuuming and cleaning up the house. And I turned on the vacuum cleaner and I started imitating the sound that I heard. And I think it was that same day when my mom came back from the market. I said, "I'm going to be an opera singer." So that was how it began, and it has not changed. So I think it was my destiny.
That's incredible. So at this point, you've probably had many, many career highlights, but where you are today, are there any that still stand out to you as particularly special?
Well, yes, there are very many, and some are special because of one reason or another, but the most special ones, of course, when I won the Metropolitan Opera competition, when I made my Metropolitan Opera debut as Pamina in The Magic Flute on that same stage, when I premiered Scott Joplin's opera, Tremonitia. That's a nice story, and it's one of the stories that you hear about in the movies, I think. I was doing a smaller part at Wolf Trap. That summer I had done Tupton and the King and I, and so this particular opera company from the South, I think from Georgia, Atlanta, was coming up with this opera, Tremonitia, by Scott Joplin, who of course was known as the King of Rag. And so in that particular opera production, I was given the role of Lucy. Now Lucy is Tremonitia's best friend, and she sings exactly one line in the opera, as well as a little small part in the duet, A Real Slow Drag, which is the finale. And I was happy to do that. It was fun. The music was different. I mean, we were singing in classical style, but it was a rag rhythm underneath us. And so that was a unique experience for me. And I remember being so motivated by the music and the slow drag that I was dancing up a storm. I couldn't keep still on the stage next to the woman doing Tremonitia. And as the story goes, the second performance, we had five. The second performance, the tenor, who was Tremonitia's boyfriend, Remus, he took ill with laryngitis. Now they had an understudy, but the understudy was afraid to sing the aria, "Wrong is Never Right," which is given to the tenor. And it's a kind of an aria that doesn't have to be sung by a man. It could be sung by a woman because they're words of wisdom and admonishing the townspeople that never to do wrong. And so the conductor and the stage director, they came to me and said, "Do you think you can sing that aria? The tenor will do the other parts with Tremonitia, but can you sing that aria? I mean, Tremonitia and I are both kidnapped, so it would be logical that I would come back and admonish people, even to, you know, in spite of my character, who I was. So I said, sure, I think I could sing it. I mean, it was within my range, and you know, tenors and sopranos sing in the same range, just an octave apart. And I, that day I sang through the aria. I knew the staging. It was basically the entire crowd sits down and you kind of wander around and address each one and that kind of thing. So it was a standalone aria. And we didn't tell anybody in the chorus who was going to sing the aria for many reasons, you know, for the understudy and, you know, to protect him and that sort of thing. We just sort of shifted it in the moment. So I, when that time came in the opera, I stood up and, of course, the entire stage crew, they were looking at me like, why are you standing up? What's happening? And I started singing the aria, and it was quite a different energy coming from them at that point. But in the audience was Gunther Schuller and Vera Lawrence. Vera Lawrence was a woman who had the rights to the Joplin estate and had the right to say what was done with his work, his body of work. So at the conclusion of the performance, I had a knock on my door, my dressing room door, and it was Vera Lawrence and the conductor, the world famous conductor, Gunther Schuller. And so as they spoke to me and complimented me and really thanked me for stepping in at the last minute, because I had only heard about it that morning. This was done in one day. And they said, you know, we were so impressed by you that we want to let you know that if Treemonish is ever done again, produced again, we will have them come to you and offer you the role of Treemonish. So, you know, I thanked them. I thought that was wonderful. And I was very thrilled and happy that they thought that highly of my work. And because the thing is, Gunther Schuller was about to reorchestrate the piece. And of course, being a composer, the first, T.J. Anderson was the first composer of it. And he did a version that was more closely, would have more closely represented what Joplin would have had access to in terms of other instruments, not too many strings, that sort of thing. But Gunther, of course, brought a European size orchestra to support the opera and very much enhanced it and took it to another plane. So about 6 months later, I got a call from Houston Grand Opera and they said, we're doing Treemonish. And I said, okay. And they said, we were told to offer the role to you first. Are you available? Are you interested? I said, absolutely. Now, during that time, I was also in the middle of singing for the Metropolitan Opera audition competition. And I was, at that point, I had made it into the semifinals. So I still had the finals to go. And so when I went up to New York and I sang in the semifinals, then I made it into the finals. But in the time, in the year that I won the Met, it was the last year that they divided it up into first, second, and third place winners. And the rest, of course, were honorable mentions. But I was the last year of a first place winner. And while standing on that Met stage after we had all sung our rounds, Shirley Verrett was announcing the winners. And when Shirley Verrett called my name as the first place winner, I couldn't move. I was frozen. And I was clapping because I was sure that someone else was supposed to be going toward her. And as I was standing there clapping, along with everyone else clapping, it suddenly dawned on me that everyone on the stage, and the donors were also sitting in chairs, and all the other contestants were sitting behind a particular donor, they were all looking at me. And I'm still clapping. And I said, oh dear. Then I, with shaky legs, I walked up to Shirley, and we embraced. And there's a photo of us embracing, which is so wonderful, that I have kept. Of course, Shirley has passed on now, but I have that photo in my music room, and I'm so proud of that moment. So that's another highlight of my life.
Given the scope of your career, and I don't really even know that it's possible to have that kind of career today, talk a little bit about what today's classical artists can expect.
Well, definitely things are different today. I mean, things are different for one very important reason, and that's the with the introduction of social media. And this idea that you can have instant connection around the world. And I say it like this, when I was coming up, if you wanted to contact a company and you wanted to introduce yourself, or an agent and you wanted to introduce yourself, you had to have a packet. And the packet was comprised of your bio, your repertoire list, your picture, your photo, and anything that you reviews of that sort of thing. And you would send that off in the mail, very expensive if you had to do several packets like that. And maybe they would reach, and maybe they would land on the desk of a general manager of an opera company or his assistant, and maybe they didn't. Maybe they just went into a pile somewhere. Because definitely word of mouth was the best way to advertise. So if you worked with someone in a company and you had a good rapport and a good report that they could carry forward, usually one company manager would talk to another company manager and say, okay, how was it working with this particular artist? Oh, they're fantastic. No drama, you know. So, and you would get a call, or your agent would get a call. And it was usually that kind of thing. With social media being what it is, and the internet, the birth of the internet and its accessibility to the average person, any person, now you can do everything electronically. You can have your website. So, I mean, we find that we're talking to our students about, have you established your website yet with your performances to date, with all of the things that you've studied to date? I mean, you may still be a student, but that website is going to build and change as you go along. And if people can access you electronically on their cell phones, I mean, I grew up when we had to go into a phone booth to make a call, and it was very expensive to make a long distance call. But now you can text, you can email, you can call free on your phone. You can send someone a link to your website on your phone. So it's in one sense, it's so efficient, it's scary. In another sense, it allows for this massive onslaught of information traveling all over the place to people. And people are approaching general managers just off the street, so to speak. You know, just here I am, this is me, this is my work. Rather than, and the idea of having a manager represent you is kind of becoming obsolete. Mm-hmm. It's just becoming really obsolete. Managers who've established themselves and have a good rapport with companies, they still have a business. They still have an opportunity to feed these particular artists through to a company. But it's hard to answer your question about the access right to the company managers. There was something called Opera America, mm-hmm. That was just getting started back when I was doing a little bit more of the circulating in the United States. And that was a situation where all of the regional opera companies in the United States would come together, the managers would come together in one room. And you had to be sponsored by a company that you'd worked with to come and audition for all the general managers in the United States at one time. Mm-hmm. It was phenomenal. It was a phenomenal event. And the Baltimore Opera Company represented me, sponsored me rather, and I went to that audition and made powerful connections to San Francisco Opera, to Houston Grand Opera, to other opera companies, to Michigan Opera Theater along the way. I don't think that exists at this point because, as I said, people can access so readily electronically that to have all these company managers, you know, come into one place is expensive. Hotel, airfare, all these things. So people are looking for ways to be much more frugal, especially company managers in this economy. So it is a different scene. This also was the advent of televising, again, electronically televising performances and productions to more people. For instance, the Met now can be seen, their live productions can be seen in theaters, in regional theaters, in real time. Mm-hmm. So this is a phenomenal thing to be looking at a Met performance live in a movie theater. You know, it's just an amazing thing. So all of that has changed the entire environment of the classical artists today. Another thing is that there are composers writing today who are writing in a great deal more of the musical theater style. now when we have to prepare our singers to go and sing an audition, that in addition to the classical style of singing, they have to prepare a musical theater piece. And this is so that companies can keep up with their productions of new works by living composers, and makes it more relevant. You know, something like a musical that's out now, very popular, Hamilton, you know, where the singers have to be trained so that the classical singing voices are what's coming across, but it's in a context of a musical theater style. So that's that category is beginning to broaden quite rapidly today. So yes, it's very, very different from the way it was when I was coming along earlier. And it's something that those in my generation have to keep up with. We have to make that ourselves accessible to that so that we can stay relevant. And the bottom line for me is that the act of singing doesn't change. The quality doesn't change. Bel canto doesn't change. But the context in which you do it has changed dramatically.
That's really powerful. So how are you seeing access to information change vocal technique, or the vocal technique that your students come in with? Have there been any major changes because of what they're consuming online?
Well, yes. And unfortunately, I have to say that it's not necessarily positive, because growing up during my early training days, there was also recordings that you could listen to. We could go in and listen to those things in libraries, or you could purchase them. But you have to understand the nature of a recording. A recording is, you have changed the pathway of the voice, you've amplified it, you've enhanced it electronically. And an engineer can do many, many things. So a voice that sounds really huge over an orchestra, perhaps the engineer just lowered the orchestra's intensity for that to happen on a recording. And so the singer, the novice may listen to that and say, oh, I have to make my voice big. I have to be able to sing over an orchestra. And they will sacrifice quality. You know, if they're not guided, they will sacrifice quality. I instruct my singers to only listen to something to further enhance what they've already worked on personally, because you want to be able to produce your voice, not mimic someone else's voice or try to replicate it to the nth degree. We also were taught that sometimes mistakes are made on recordings. And if a singer is using a recording as a sole guide to do something, then you're going to learn that mistake as well. So learning how to look at the score, assess the score, break the score down, understand what the composer is trying to get across through the topography of the notes that he's written, and how they flow on the page, and how they flow on that staff and above it and below it, and understanding rhythmically what the composer is trying to do and how he set the text. Those things come from that kind of intense personal study. And for instance, the first thing I admonish my students to do is to mark the rhythm. I mean, it's an elementary thing. It's a, you know, primary level thing. But you'd be surprised how singers will learn something incorrectly rhythmically and carry that into almost the final stages, still trying to correct it because they've repeated it so many times. Or they'll say a little passage which has a little difficulty, tricky rhythm or tricky note pattern. Oh, I always make that mistake. But they never stop to figure it out, to fix it. And so going forward, you learn it with that mistake in it. And it's very hard. And eventually, either you just have to leave it alone and do it with a mistake, or whatever. But I think to honor the score, to honor what the composer left by learning it, you know, correctly, learning it, taking it as he put it, and then lifting it off the page to suit your particular capacity of breath and energy and rhythm and coordination, your skills, is what you do first. And then when you have a rendition of it, whatever it is, the role, the aria, the song, then you can listen to one of the established singers to see what, if anything, did they do differently? How did they handle that little passage? Ah, they juxtapositioned the syllable. Ah, they took a breath earlier, you see. So these things further enhance what you've already worked on. But you don't sit there and just play it 6,000 times and just try to get up and mimic it, because that's not real study. And so I think that to approach learning music, or to approach study in that manner is detrimental. I don't care what the genre is. I think it needs, a person needs to really study to create a sense of connection, personal connection to the music. And then they can look around to see what, if anything, anyone else can offer as a way of enhancing what they already are doing.
I think that is probably one of the most powerful tips I have heard. And I hope it is received in the same fashion by listeners, because I do think that we are in the generation and era where perfect imitation is really considered success. But you're talking about something quite different. And I love how you even broaden that to include all the other genres that might even be considered easier, like popular music. But what you're really talking about is almost the technique to ensure that what you deliver will be individual and will carry your fingerprint and not just be a very, very good copy.
Exactly. Exactly right. It is so important. It really is important that you own the piece. You know, your communication is going to be honest then.
Yes, and I would imagine it would also free you from some of the fear that comes with having to do it just right.
Because
if in your mind doing it just right is doing it just like the record, and you're not the person who recorded it, there's a different level of anxiety that comes. So that really speaks to so many things.
And because you're collaborating, because you probably are not going to be singing a cappella, because you're collaborating, you have to have that ability to work spontaneously in the moment. You can go with it, you can flow with it. But if it's got to be this set thing or that set thing, then that can cause you problems.
I want to ask you this. We know that you're a wealth technically, but I think there has to be a balance to the technique as well. You're still a person delivering this gift to the world. So what three lessons learned, or what three top tips would you give to singers in terms of balancing the creative gift and living as an individual in the world?
The first thing I would say is eat well, sleep well, think good thoughts.
Can you break those down for us a little bit? That's good.
If the body is the instrument, and the body is not being taken care of, and the body begins to break down, it doesn't matter how pretty you can sing or how well you're trained, you have a problem. Because you need your energy, and you need to start thinking about feeding your body at the cellular level. And if you're thinking about that, then you need to think about, what is it that my cells need? Not my taste buds, but my cells. So a good, viable knowledge of nutrition is necessary. What must I eat? And you must start in your youth thinking about this, okay? Or wherever you are. Think about it now and make today the first day for the rest of your life that you're going to think about food differently. The second one, if you don't get proper rest, then again, you're going to pull on the body's resources. You're going to put the body at a deficit. But you're going to demand that the body produce this energy for you when you want to sing. And the body will struggle because it still has to keep you alive. If you think about all the systems and the activities that are going on just to keep you alive, that you don't have to consciously think about, it would be mind-boggling. If you had to stop to think about breathing, to think about what your spleen does, to think about digestion, to think about heart beating, to think about, you know, eyes blinking, to think about, again, you know, swallowing, all of these, and the blood flow. And the lymphatic system. And with all of that, if you had to actually consciously think about the activity that's going on, which is being conducted from your brain, that's why your brain is what it is and has so many compartments, you couldn't do anything else, and you certainly couldn't sing. So getting the proper rest so that the body can repair and be ready to produce energy for you is crucial. So sometimes you have to let something go in order to get that body rest, because the body starts to detox starting from about midnight and 3 a.m. So if you get to bed and let the body have that good, beautiful time of detoxing and repairing itself, then you're well on your way. And I think the other thing is, we can't control our voices with our fingers in our hands, like a pianist can or an instrumentalist can. We can't even look at our voices as the notes are coming out of our mouths as a pianist or an instrumentalist can. Okay, so how do we control it? We control it with what we think. Our thoughts control our singing. So if your thoughts are skewed and aberrated, well, your singing is going to follow. So having a clear mind about exactly what you need to do, having a clear mind about exactly what it is you are supposed to do, become a singing actor or actress, communicating to the public, moving the public into a place where within their own imaginations they can join you, is what the gig is what the job is. So making sure that what you think about singing is proper and conducive to the best singing you can do. And if, for example, if someone thinks that singing well should be a difficult task, that's already wrong. Singing is something that we have in our package. It's an elongation of speech, and we change the pitch around, and we sustain vowel sounds. So it can't be rocket science, not when you compare it to the rest of the stuff that's going on in our bodies. So the simplistic, holistic, intuitive approach to singing is going to be producing bel canto. And it's what the old great teachers knew. So pacing yourself well, not trying to do something, not trying to rehearse and practice when you're really exhausted and tired, not repeating and scrubbing over some difficult passage over and over again without thinking, okay, this time when I repeat it, what do I want to accomplish? What am I looking to accomplish with this repeat? So that your practice time becomes efficient and you're building for the performance so that you get to the point where you are practicing the performance.
Wow. That's such focused and clear instruction about the way that we ought to think, the way that we ought to rest, and the way that we ought to feed our bodies. Wow.
The one thing, if I may, I want to add, it's the one piece about exercise. Exercise and coordinating the body. Actually, I started out walking a mile a day. And it made me feel so good that I said, well, what if I walk three laps? I was running, doing around the track. I said, what if I walk three laps and sort of lightly jog the fourth one, just kind of end on a high, right? Little did I know, endorphins were waiting for me. Then I got to the point where after that felt, okay, I think I'll jog the last two laps. And so after a while, I was literally jogging a mile. And then the mile added on one more lap. And long story short, I got up to 8 miles a day, five times a week, cross country. The track became too small and too monotonous. So I started cross country. And at one point I did run Daytona Beach 15 miles at once. But exercising and being physically fit became a part of who I am and what I wanted to do from the time I started in college. And I've never stopped from that point. And so giving birth to two daughters and traveling around the world, of course, I had to adjust my exercise. I consider that at this point in my life, I've evolved to doing Qigong and Tai Chi. If you look at them just very methodically in terms of you don't need equipment, you don't have to go anywhere to experience it. There could be a blizzard outside and you could still do your Qigong and keep your body fit and keep yourself on course. Those exercises affect the blood flow in your body, the skeletal system, the muscular system, the lymphatic system, and all the organs and your breath. It is so complete and it travels very nicely because it's in your head. That's a huge component part of the eating well, the resting well, and the thinking well is exercise. And when you address all those issues in your body, then you are building a lean machine and you can expect your body to deliver. If you deliver to your body those things, it will respond to you beautifully. That's what I've discovered.
Very powerful. Let's play a quick game. I'm going to think of five questions at random. This game is called This or That, and you just tell me which you prefer. Okay, are you ready?
Yes.
Spring, summer, winter, or fall?
Summer.
Okay. Coffee or tea?
Tea.
Mountains or beach?
Mountains.
Red or blue?
Blue.
Elderly or infant? I stumped her.
Yes. Infant.
Okay. Sail or fly?
Sail.
Okay, excellent. So today we've met with Carmen Balthrop, and as you've heard, just a wealth of wisdom, a professor at the University of Maryland at College Park for a number of years. And I guess at the university website, people could
see
you out there.
Okay. Yes.
Good. And with our last 2 minutes, if there were three resources, maybe books or films or something like that, that you would recommend to creative people, what would those three resources be?
Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain.
Okay, tell me what you like about that book.
Well, it's Betty Edwards, who is teaching you how to perceive and see. She teaches non-art majors, and they say, oh, I can't draw, I can't paint. And she says, no, the problem is you can't see. So it's how to use the right brain, which is the brain that we sing from, that side of our brain, and how to get into that area more quickly, more efficiently. She changes your life in that once you experience her book, when you look around you, you don't see things. You see lights and shadows and depth and clarity and angles like you've never seen them before. So she takes you to a whole other realm of visual. The Power of Habit.
The Power of Habit.
Charles Duhigg.
Yes.
Teaching you how habits are formed and how they can be broken. Beautiful book. I was so moved by this book. I emailed him and I called him and emailed him and said, thank you for writing this book. I'm going to use it and recommend it to every one of my students. And Power Performance for Singers. In this book, which was written by my former teacher, there are clues and tips and exercises to do. Doesn't matter the genre of music you sing, but to prepare for auditions, for competitions, for performance. And she gets into the mindset, which is what I was referring to earlier. What you think matters. Power Performance for Singers by Shirley Emmons.
Okay. Those are three excellent books. I have all three, and you're right. Those are fantastic. So thanks for the recommendation, and thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.